everybody, get ready for Foodie and the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis. A foodie born and bred, my wife Nikki loves chatting up chefs, dining out, and insider industry buzz.
And my husband David thinks a great meal is nothing but a good burger, a frosty brew, and a check for under $20. Because he is cheap.
Well, maybe so, but Foodie married Beast anyway, and together we've got the Food and Wine Variety Show that has everyone talking.
It's Foodie and the Beast, and we are on now.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Foodie and the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis on this lovely Sunday, kind of. We've got a great show today. Before we get into it, Nick, do you want to tell everybody what's going on this week?
Yeah, so, it is the hazy, hot days of summer here in D.C. We get this every July. We're in the middle of a heat wave, but that doesn't mean... Yeah, everybody's schwitzing. But given what's going on with the pandemic, you do have to be careful. You do have to wear a mask. You do have to social distance. You do have to wash your hands. But you do also need to get out and see what's happening in and around the D.C. metro area. Area restaurants are really doing everything they can to accommodate in a safe way, whether you're going to do takeout, whether you're going to sit on a patio, whether you're going to dine indoors, have cocktails or wine. You can head to the list or youonit.com. We have everything that's happening in the DC metro area, from patio openings to who's doing the latest in takeaway to all those special marketplaces. More and more restaurants are offering ways to do you're shopping through them. So check it all out. It's all there on the website. David, why don't you tell everybody who's on the show this week?
Why don't I? All right. For all you DC wine connoisseurs who think that all the action is downtown, I guess the question is, have you been to the Wine Kitchen in Leesburg or Frederick? Because if you haven't, you should have. Wine Kitchen is a Rammy nominee for Wine Program of the Year. And we've got the Wine Kitchen's assistant manager and head of their wine program, Justin Langley, with us to talk about the nomination and his favorite wine of the moment, of the hot moment. In late June, wine writer and educator Julia Coney launched something called the Black Wine Professionals. It's a database featuring vetted black wine talent for people in the wine business who say they want to diversify their wine business. She's going to join us later in the show. There's some big news for DC's Ward 8, big job news and economic development news. City-State Brewing is a DC-centric craft microbrewery, taproom, and community gathering space, I guess you'd say. They broke down on broke ground on July 22nd for its new site on Edgewood Street Northeast. We're going to have owner James Warner in to talk about that and his Opportunity Zone Fund that he started to really help the neighborhood up its game in economic development. And Chef Eric Ajapong is joining us again. He was a finalist on season 16 of Bravo's Top Chef. He was a contestant on season 17 of Top Chef All-Stars, this last one. And he launched a series of virtual interactive cooking classes. You're going to hear all about that and how he's teaching Black history and the influence of African culture on cuisine virtually. So, but first, we're going to go to Mitch Berliner of Central Farm Markets with a whole pitch on one-stop shopping. According to Mitch, except for plastic goods and paper goods, you don't need to go anywhere else. Am I right, Mitch?
You are 1,000% right. Good morning, kids. How
Please
are you?
Please tell my wife that.
Absolutely. We are indeed your one-stop shop. When you think about shopping, we really have it all. We have fishmongers and we have fishermen. We have the largest selection of regional cheese. We have even roasted nuts. We have coffee roasters. We have all kinds of bakeries, charcuterie, prepared foods. We even have beer and spirits. We have every kind of meat. Goat, veal, different kinds of heritage breeds of beef, pork, chicken. So we really have it all. And needless to say, the big draw is always the produce there, which is outstanding. We're in the height of the season right now. So we've got the watermelons. We've got yellow and red. We have something called canary melons. And maybe your viewers or listeners haven't heard about that. But it looks like a football. And it's like a bright yellow. And it's a little similar to a honeydew. You don't generally find that in too many places, but they are like sugar and they're full of juice. They're outstanding. That's one of the things about farmers markets in general. You can get a lot of things in farmers market produce-wise that you're not going to get in the general store. So you're
I think we got to say it's safer to shop in the outdoors like that than in an enclosed space too. So.
Well, and also, Mitch, I want to say, though, when you go to a farmer's market, unlike a grocery store, right? The grocery store, you know the rows, you know where things are. And because everything changes at the farmers markets, what people are offering every week, what's your advice so that when people go, they can shop efficiently? Do you know what I mean? Like, when I go to the farmers market, I'm always like, oh, there's so much here and it's a little overwhelming. So what's your advice to sort of do your homework before you go so that you can shop efficiently and also get access to maybe some new products that you're not familiar with?
Well, that's a great question. We put out a weekly e-blast. Debbie and Lynn put out an e-blast that's outstanding. And we talk about what's new that week. And talk about efficient, you can actually go online and you can order in advance with each farmer and specialty food producer, you name it. And we do have people who come in and they're in and out in 10 minutes and they know what they're getting, et cetera. They usually pick up a few extra things. So you could be very efficient if you want. And don't be afraid to talk to your farmer and say, what is this? Like, we have shishito peppers. A lot of people don't know what that is. You just like you just pan fry them a little till they're brownish. They're outstanding. So there's a lot of things that you can get, again, that you don't find normally anyplace else. So
right. Okay, so where can people sign up for that newsletter, Mitch?
Well, we have three locations. We have one in Northern Virginia and Bethesda, Maryland. There are Sunday markets. They're both open year-round. Northern Virginia is at on the parking lot of the Church of the Holy Comforter, and the Bethesda market's on the parking lot of the Bethesda Elementary School. And that's every Sunday, about 8:30 to 1, 8:30 to 12:30 in that range for the Nova market. And in Bethesda, it's 9 to 1:30. And then today we have our market at Pike and Rose in North Bethesda. And that's open from 9 to 1:30 also. Come on out and visit us and you can find everything you need to know and sign up for our e-blast at centralfarmmarkets.com.
All right. Great. Thanks, Mitch.
Mitch, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Don't ever change.
We'll see you at the market.
All right.
I'm going to change my shirt, I promise.
And your socks. All right. So let's talk wine on summer days in a great setting. The Wine Kitchen is a Rammy nominee for Wine Program of the Year. They're in scenic Frederick, and scenic Leesburg. And Justin Langley's with us. He's the Wine Kitchen's assistant manager, but he's their wine guru as well. Justin, how are you?
I'm doing just fine. How's it going?
It's going
great.
Good.
So Justin, let me just jump in here for a sec, because for those of you who listen every week, we feature at the beginning of the show a Rammy nominee, because the Rammies are the Restaurant Association of Metropolitan Washington's annual awards for incredible service and food quality and wine quality, etc., for people in the DC area restaurant industry. And it should have happened in July. It didn't. And there will be a huge event in September, September 20th. I mean, it may be a virtual huge event, but it's going to happen nonetheless. And all the nominees that we have been featuring throughout the last 2 months, you'll find out who the winner is on September 20th. And the Wine Kitchen, which is out in Frederick, I think it's kind of interesting because most people don't think of restaurants when we're celebrating the DC metro area in Frederick. So Justin, is there any way you can speak to like why you guys are members of the Restaurant Association of Metropolitan Washington?
Oh, well, certainly. I mean, Frederick as a whole, I think is, every year becomes more and more a suburb of DC. So, I mean, just the sheer amount of people that live here and commute to DC every day is pretty numerous. So, I mean, it's really not that far. So,
love Frederick. We love Frederick. We go there a lot. We've been to the Wine Kitchen. We think it's a fabulous space. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the Wine Kitchen and sort of how long it's been around and its genesis and what's happening there?
Sure. The Wine Kitchen that I work at personally in Frederick's been open for 8 going on 9 years, I believe. I've been there for about 2. The original one in Leesburg opened, I believe, 4 or 5 years prior to that. Both have been wildly successful. The whole point of our program really is to really showcase wines and that are more on the affordable side, if you will. You're not going to really find anything by the glass. Like everything, well, first of all, the entire program is done by the glass. So anything that's on the list, you can get a bottle or glass, or you can also do tasting pours, and we do flights of everything as well. That's, you know,
it's well, just, so, let me jump in with a question, because what do you do with the uninitiated? In other words, people walk in and they really don't know much about wine. Do you guys have classes, or do you just spend that much time with a newbie to help explain not just the program, but what the individual wine selections are like?
Well, another thing we do is, so like I said, everything is listed as flights. And then so we have not only just information on the wines that go with, you know, when we serve a flight, but we actually word it in a way so it's a little more whimsical and a little more fun. So it's definitely just more approachable for the general public. So people.
Well, can I jump in? So a flight of wine, for people maybe who don't know what that means, what does that mean when I go to the wine kitchen if I get a flight?
It's going to be 3 2-ounce pours. Basically, so, and is it
thematic? How do you put those flights together?
They'll have a theme to them, whether they be all white, certain stylistically red. We have a sparkling wine flight. We have a flight that's only French wine. And that one's a lot of fun too, because you get a white, a rosé, and a red. And then you're going to have, then we have like a Pinot Noir flight, because, you know, that's a certain varietal that tends to be,
Is it by regions? I mean, in other words, if you're giving me a Pinot Noir flight, do I have an Oregon and a French and a, you know, I mean,
and a California? Yes, yeah. That's exactly it. You just nailed it.
Okay. Cause I need a second job.
And what are you guys doing now, like with the whole COVID pandemic? How were you guys able to use the overused term pivot to get wine and your food to the Frederick community?
Well, we've gone above and beyond as far as table spacing. Our tables inside are more like 10 to 12 feet apart, first of all. Also, we've put like all of our tables together so that, you know, a table that you'd normally sit 6 people at, that's a table that we would sit 2 people at, just to give spacing even more and more. There's also things that we do, like we provide like bags on the table for each person to put their face mask in. Everything is touchless, so that, you know, we have laminated cards that you can scan. So you can look at the menus on your phone that way. All payment is done so you can just scan a QR code. So we don't have to take your credit card.
That's great. What system? I'm just curious. What system are you using?
I don't remember the name of that.
I was just curious.
I need Jason's help for that one.
Okay.
so sorry for that. They just had me do the
wine. You're in charge of the wine.
In charge of the important part.
So right, listen, we want to congratulate you for your Rammy nominee, and we want to thank you for joining us today. Can you tell everybody where they can find you online, please?
Sure. You can just visit us at thewinekitchen.com. Simple enough.
All right. Excellent. Justin, before you go, you got 10 seconds. What's the one wine to drink when it's so hot out?
Right now, Forge Cellars Riesling out of Seneca Lake in upstate New York.
Okay, we know it.
A Finger Lakes wine. All right, thank you. All right, this is David and Nikki Nellis at Foodie and the Beast. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Julia Coney about racism in the wine industry. We'll be back in just a sec.
All right, we're back on Foodie and the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis. Late last month, wine writer and educator Julia Coney launched a great website, Black Wine Professionals. It's actually a database featuring vetted black wine talent for folks that own wine businesses who say they want to diversify their wine business and find more talent in more unusual places.
Okay, but we're going to back up a little bit, because she is so much more than her most recent output. I know Julia for quite some time. She is a wine writer, wine educator, speaker, and wine consultant. She is well known nationally and internationally for her take on wines. And she's really one of the few women of color who is out there as publicly talking about wine in an industry that is woefully in the people of color being raised up. And I think Julia is really looking to change that. So Julia, you and I have talked forever about you coming on the show. I'm so glad you can join us today. Can you just give us a little of your background? How did you get into wine?
So I got into wine. I come from a legal background. I was a legal assistant. And I got into wine in the late 90s. And at that time, I was living in Houston. So I'm from Houston. And one of the attorneys I was, and I studied abroad in France. So even then, it wasn't like I really got into wine. It was just, you have wine because it's cheaper to drink than soda. Right? It's just, and it's there. It goes,
wait a minute, it sounds like
as it should be.
Hold on, hold on. It sounds like you're saying that the law drove you to drink.
Well, no, eventually it did, because I always had lawyers. That's one of the things, is their way of having a contest, because they're not like neurosurgeons compared to another kind of doctor. So for lawyers, there's like, what do we drink? Right. Mm-hmm. And he just really, and I asked him a question. I was like, you're really, really into this. I don't understand. We get in all these boxes and they're all wine. And he was like, hey, I'm having a barbecue at the house where I actually pair a lot of the wines I just got back from California with the barbecue. Won't you come over and like hang out and I'll explain it? And he literally sat me down. We paired brisket ribs with Napa Valley Cabernet. You have to think back then, this is the 99. This is late. Mm-hmm. This is Napa's height, if you wanted to say. And he just walked me through it. He was like, this is how you look through the glass. This is what you're smelling. This is what you're saying, what you smell. Does it happen to have the same flavor profile? So he was my first teacher. Of just casually introducing me to wine. Then he introduced me to the Wall Street Journal columnists, Dorothy Gator and John Brusher, their column Tasting. And then I just started exploring and going to wine regions as a young single woman with no kids and no boyfriend. It was like, let's just travel and go to these places and drink wine in a new way.
And how did that transform into a career? Because now you have this incredible career.
Well, I moved to DC in 2005, and in 2006, I actually started a really popular beauty blog. It became really so popular that I actually quit my legal career in 2010 to actually freelance. And then slowly, within the end of 2015, I just did not feel a pull to do beauty. I felt a pull to do food and wine, but I specifically didn't want to be a food writer. I love food writing. I knew I didn't want to be a food writer, and I was like, I don't see a lot of wine professionals of color. And so because wine drew me in for 20 something years, I just took that experience, then started taking actual certification classes to hone it and tighten it up. And then just spent a year working really from literally living off my savings to building a wine writing career.
Well, but you've built an incredible wine writing career. I mean, in the past, I've done some work with Napa Valley Vintners Association, and they're always like, where's Julia? I mean, your people really want you there. But I'd love to go back a little bit. I'm sort of curious, what do you think it is about sort of the wine industry's purview about reaching out to Black drinking consumers?
I think
if you think about ads and stuff like that, or, when you think about wine, it seems to be looking in a white direction, not a diverse direction.
Well, I think we don't associate Black wine drinkers. We associate Black as entertainment, but not as far as wine drinkers. We also associate a lot of Black drinkers with spirits. So the spirits world is doing amazing with that. It's the wine world that isn't. And so it is okay. And I talk to people about that. Like, if you're placing an ad in a magazine or you're on your website, put stock photos, go and find stock photos of people of color drinking wine. They're not, you can Photoshop your bottle somewhere on it, but if you're doing just social media, find people the way the world looks, because that's the way the world looks.
Right. So now with what you do and the kind of talks you give, there are people of color out there who are writing about wine and the wine industry, and there are SOMs out there, but they're just not as elevated. How are you helping with that platform?
Well, that's why I built the new platform called Black Wine Professionals. It's where if you need a SOM, if you need a wine educator, if you need to talk to a wine buyer, here are a list of names of people. If you're trying to get your wine in front of someone and they have a shop, here's the list, and here's where they are. Because now you can do this virtually, right? How do we sell the wine virtually? Well, we know and I also have importers. Here's a list of importers. If you're trying to bring your product, or here's a list of distributors. That way you can't tell me you didn't know there was a black distributor who could bring your product into a new market.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that's what it is, that they just don't know, or they never looked, or is it more overt?
They never looked. They never thought it was in their purview. They never thought that they needed to. Right. It was basically thinking, I don't need a demographic that it's just people's perception. But when you look now, I mean, unless you're talking wine and celebrity, correct? If it's mm-hmm. wine and celebrity and you're talking, just say, you know, the NBA and those guys who really, really know wine, that's the way people talk about wine. But we're not talking those people. We're talking the consumer, where you're missing out on a big part of Black buying power because we look at your ads on social and we don't see ourselves represented. I don't need it in every photo, but if you have a list of 200 photos and there's not one person of color, not one Black person, not one Asian person, then there's a disconnect.
Hmm. Well, I totally agree with you. And do you also think when it comes to wine writing, without having the voices, I mean, you know, for a long time, it was talking about the fact that women didn't have a seat at the table, right? Mm-hmm. And over the last, you know, 10, 15 years, especially, there's been a huge wave of women who are making their voices heard. And now we're all looking and saying, oh, there's no people of color here either. We need to make room at the table for them, right?
Yes.
So what is it that people are missing? Just like women said, well, when you don't get a woman's perspective, you're missing X. When you don't get a person of color's perspective on the taste of a wine or their palate, people need to understand that diversity is so important with what you're drinking.
Also, too, it goes to also cultural perspective. If we think of the way wine writing has been with food, it is mm-hmm. always seen as a higher end food, right? And that's mm-hmm. great. But there's a place for cultural reference, right? Why isn't there anything where we're talking pairing wine with jerk chicken, Jamaican food, right? Right. If I'm from the South and I'm eating Creole Cajun food, there's wines for that. That has yeah. to be a part. So that's why, like when I talk in pairings, I always go back to seafood, crawfish, gumbo, etouffee, because that's what I grew up on. I also grew up on caviar as well, but let's talk from those perspectives. Like if you're talking Caribbean food, mofongo, right? Does this wine pair with sofrito? We have to ask those questions, but those questions and those stories haven't been written about, because if you don't grow up eating those things or thinking wine in those terms with those foods, you're not going to get that perspective.
Well, I just want to jump in, Julia, yes. because you've left out my people. My people are the people that eat Five Guys and drink wine.
But so. think about champagne and fried chicken, right?
Right.
Right. Before, uh-huh. had that been a Black person pairing champagne and fried chicken, it would have been looked down on, because every white psalm loved that pairing is now a thing that everybody writes about.
But no, it's a good point.
Right? Because if I'm thinking fried chicken, I'm thinking Popeyes from the South.
Right.
From spicy, right? I'm not going in, you know, on the fried chicken I grew up on. In the South, you grew up on fried chicken, right? Mm-hmm. And so we have to, the new voices that I'm mentoring and writing as well will bring all of their personality, their upbringing into the new way we actually write and discuss wine.
Well, that brings up a good point, because aside from your own kind of virtual Rolodex, how did you go about gathering data? How do you reach out to all these people? How do you know where to find them? To put
because
them on the
I
website.
Actually, one of the things I feel like when I reach out for, when I think of women in wine, I just literally start Googling. I hashtag mm-hmm. and I go now on the hashtags for on social media. But a lot of those people I personally knew, and they were telling me the stories of, I didn't get to go on this media trip and everybody went and they picked a person from the restaurant with less experience than me. Why did that happen?
Well, let's talk about that, because you and I have discussed that before. So let's talk about wine education, which mm-hmm. these media trips are very much for, and sort of what you saw missing in them.
Well, I saw people not getting the same opportunities as other people. If you're taking Psalms from New York, you know, just say, and I mean men and women, and you take mm-hmm. 10 Psalms and everybody's white, I know 10 Psalms that are Black. In New York, I know 10 Psalms that are Latina in New York. How did you miss? And I mean, they're popular restaurants. I mean, they're the ones that's mm-hmm. in all the magazines. So that means you're not thinking of them, because if everybody's in your business is white, you come from that perspective. That's also why you always need to have another person to say, hey, maybe we should look and say, why are these media trips so white, taking the same group of people, no new voices as well? It's not like I want to go on every trip. I want somebody to experience that, because when you go to those regions and actually taste the wine with the food, you have a different perspective. If you're the psalm coming back and you have that, you're explaining that to your guest. If you're writing about it, you're explaining that to your readers.
So right,
my question. Is that overt racism or sort of softer racism like paternalism or just stupidity?
I don't think it's overt. I just think it's not, if your definition of the way a wine professional looks in your mind, it is one thing. You're just trying to get the names on the list. You're trying to get the people, but because you don't have in your mind, you don't see Black people, people of color, as the people who represent the wine world. We don't represent the wine world. Black Americans represent 2% of the wine world. If we're talking wine professionals, Black are 2%. 88% is white. So we have to, you have to know that number in order, and you have to go within yourself to say, hey, I never thought about that, but now I can do better.
Well, and what do you think, I mean, and for engagement with diverse communities in the wine industry, are wine companies now coming to you, like the big ones, and saying, Julia, what should we be, like, hiring you and saying, how do we make this work? Like, what are they missing and how are you recommending, you know, creating a more diverse wine culture?
We're talking about it. We're having a conversation, and yes, some are hiring me to actually pinpoint, okay, let's go through all your social. Let's go through your Facebook. Let's go through your Instagram. Let's go. What is missing? Just look at the photos. And we start from there, right? We go from there. But then when you are thinking of placing an ad in a publication, let's look at that as well. If you have a table that's a dinner party, right? And you've taken all these beautiful photos, look at what the dinner party looks like. Mm-hmm. It's just asking those questions and making them think.
No, I think it's brilliant. And I'm hoping that the wine industry sees, and when we say wine industry, I want to be clear, it's just not a bunch of winemakers. There's a lot of players. You know, there's publicists and people who run the tasting rooms, and then there's the psalms. I mean, the wine industry is massive.
It's massive. So it's a premise, suppliers, you know, we think of distributors, importers. You know, it's so much going on, and especially tasting room, right? That's a culture of its own. That needs to be something, you know, and I talk with tasting rooms now about how do you make this, when it opens up, how do you take this perception out of what a wine drinker is? Because at the end of the day, the main color you're missing is green.
Julia, I love that.
And who doesn't love green?
Who doesn't love green?
So we are going to have to wrap up. But just quickly, like, what's happening for you these days? Like, where are you? Where can we find you? What's the best way to get your, you know, you do education. How do we keep in touch with you?
You can go to my website, juliaconey.com. You can find me on all social media at Julia Coney. And through, like, email is the best way. We're starting, one of the things I do is like these virtual wine chats usually on Monday nights. And I'm starting back those in the fall. It's just geeking out about wine. It's just talking about wine. It brings everybody together. That's what I'm trying to do, is bring the community back to a communal product.
Excellent. Well, Julia, I want to thank you so much for your time today. And as always, you are on the forefront of what is happening. And I hope we can bring you back in a couple months and you'll tell us how things have been moving forward.
Yes.
We'll be back in just a sec.
All righty. So we're back on Foodie and the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis. At the top of the show, I mentioned there's some great economic development and jobs news for Ward 8. City State Brewing Company, which is a D.C.-centric craft microbrewery. It's a tap room and a community gathering space, broke ground on a 13,000 square foot operation. I don't know what you'd call it. It's almost like a mini entertainment zone. Yeah. opening up on Edgewood Street Northeast. James Warner's the owner. He's with us online now. And James, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you. As just as much as we have ambitions to make beer in Ward 8 one day, we are in Ward 5 right now.
Oh, did I say Ward? I said Ward 8. Sorry.
That's no, no, it's no problem. We would love to be doing business there.
You want
to
do both?
Well, maybe I'm announcing a future groundbreaking. Who knows? Anyway, James, before we talk about City State and do the 411 on that, tell us a little bit about you. How'd you get from there to here?
Mm-hmm. So I thanks very much, and it's a real pleasure to be here. This is my first podcast as City State Brewing, so I'm doing
it's also a radio show, just so you know.
A radio show. Mm-hmm. So anyway, mm-hmm. we've arrived. So I was in public policy, environmental policy most of my life. I came to DC by way of Peace Corps, and I had always had a fascination with beer. I went to college in Scotland and learned a lot about the culture there and sort of the artisanal nature of it there. So I moved into a group house in DC, like everyone, like a lot of people do. And there was a spare closet that no one was using. And there was a friend of mine who's getting rid of some homebrew equipment, and I'd always wanted to try it. And this is like 2007, 2008. And I got totally hooked on it. I just loved the process and the creativity. And it was sort of a hobby while I was working on the Hill and working on climate change policy. But as that progressed, and I worked in the Senate, and then the person I was working for lost, and just sort of looking at my mid-30s onwards at that point, I really got the feeling that I wanted to be an entrepreneur and wanted to run my own shop. I guess you could say the politics and policy drove me to entrepreneurship. But I also saw an opportunity in DC, not just for a brewery, but for a brand. I came from sort of an advertising and graphics background. My father wrote music for commercials for 25 years or more. My mother was in art and publishing and licensing. I'm from New York City originally, where, the hometown brand and people, knowing about New York City is it's part of the experience of living there. But I had the experience over and over again of people in DC who were saying, oh, I'll be leaving next year. People living here who came here for a job that they were passionate about, but without any connection to the city itself. And I just saw that there was an opportunity there for storytelling about the city and also to build a hometown brand. And beer is amazing for that. There's the Frank Zappa line. If you want to be a real country, you have to have an airline and a beer. I mean, at the very least, you have to have a beer. You can look at like National Bohemian in Baltimore. I mean, people get tattoos of that brand. The beer wasn't all that great, and it's not even made there anymore.
Well, it didn't even taste like dishwater. Are you kidding?
Right. But it's still the icon, as people see that and they know Baltimore. And I wanted DC to have more of that. The DC Brow and Three Stars, and they all did a really amazing job of preparing the groundwork in DC in a regulatory fashion in terms of the culture and everything else. So in 2014, I left politics behind, and I started waiting tables at Church Key. Anyone who's thinking about it, if your first gig waiting tables is at age 39, I would urge you to reconsider.
James, wait a minute, you know Sam Nellis.
Right.
Oh, sure. Oh,
well, that's our son.
That's our son.
Sam Nellis was, he put up with me as best he could as a manager.
Or you put up with him.
Or you put up with him. We've known him a long time. I'm sure you were putting up with him. But anyways.
The other way around, I was very good at selling beer. Working in politics is a lot of salesmanship. What I wasn't great was like keeping up with all the orders when we're in the weeds on a Friday. So
hospitality is tough.
Yeah, I'm very good at some aspects of hospitality, and really, had the opportunity when I was in grad school. I worked for Jamie Leeds for a little while at the original Hank's Oyster Bar.
Hank's Oyster Bar. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So worked in restaurants before, but never as a waiter. So that was an eye-opening experience.
Well, I want to jump you forward now because I don't want us to lose all this. Let's talk City State.
So between there and City State, I worked as a beer salesman for 5 years. I worked for Legends Limited, and I worked as a craft beer salesman in Montgomery County. And it was an unparalleled preparation for running a brewery because you can make beer all you want, but you got to know how to sell it. So I worked for Legends for 5 years and learned a tremendous amount, made a lot of connections, and we were doing all that while we raised money, and we finally raised enough to get a location, and we got a location 705 Edgewood Street Northeast, that was in September. I got the news while I was on a craft beer trip to Belgium, which is great. And we've been pushing ahead ever since. So we moving through the permit process. And 2 weeks ago, we were able to start breaking ground and start the process of building out the space. So it's after about 6 years of working, it's really exciting to be here now.
So brewery, tap room, and community space.
Yes.
One of the things I noted in there, and I just figured out why I said Ward 8, because one of the beers you're launching is 8 Wards Independent Pale Ale. So there. Mm-hmm. I got
it's just trying to
no, I figured it out. But one of the things you mentioned, because, in that area, it is hard for the community to find spaces that they can afford to rent and people together. So that's a really smart move you're making by creating that.
Yes, Mess Hall is down there, and they do a lot of event space, and Mess Hall has really been a pioneer down there. But I'm looking to get married in the district a couple of months ago, and it's very hard to find anything that was accessible at all. And we really want to be, when we're all gathering together, we want to be a gathering place. If you're having a community meeting, or you want to have, a wedding or a party or whatever it is, we want you to be able to come to us and pay a reasonable rate, if any.
Well, that makes sense. So now, how will everything come together? How are you going to do this all, especially in the middle of a pandemic? Like, how did you change your initial plan? I mean, here you have this plan for this big gathering place and all these things you're going to do. So now you've got to... I hate using this word. We have to come up with a new word. Now you got to pivot.
You're not going to say pivot, are you?
I just said it.
Well, I mean, it's kind of going back in time. If we think about breweries 15 years ago, even 10 years ago, most of them didn't have a taproom experience. Remember like Hill Farmstead or the breweries that people would like line up for hours just to go into a pretty spare room, to be able to take some beer or to set at picnic tables in a warehouse. People have always come to breweries no matter where they are and sort of what the inside looks like. Mm-hmm. Because of COVID, what we are going to be doing is making our tap room phase two. So when we open, it will be pretty no frills. We will be opening, as a brewery, as a factory. We've got outdoor seating areas, and there'll be a lot of space indoors for people to come and sit maybe in space picnic tables. But the retail part of our business is not going to be the focus the way we originally planned it to be until there's a vaccine. So in our construction process, we'll be stubbing in everything and roughing in all the connections we'll need, and the taproom area will already be permitted out. But we're going to wait until a vaccine is announced to actually build the taproom.
Well, listen, we have to wrap this up. It's been great chatting with you, and I hope you'll come back once you're open and we can talk about what it all looks like in there. When do you think you're going to open?
We are targeting October, November for our open. Our construction process, everything, we're barreling along full speed. We are still taking investors if folks are interested in that. We've also, as far as we can figure, we're the only business with our own Opportunity Zone fund. We had that go live this week. So if folks have capital gains and they're looking to invest in local business, we're there for that. And we really want to work with the city to make Opportunity Zone investment available to other small businesses in zones in DC and around the area.
See, that work on the hill paid off.
Yeah. Smart. All right. So tell everybody, James, tell everybody where they can find you.
Sure. So we are at citystatebrewing.com, citystatebrewing.com. You can also find us on Twitter at citystatebeer, and which we're most active, and Instagram on citystatebrewing as well.
Great.
And, And so great. Thank you very much. We're excited to see everybody out soon, and I'm excited to talk to you guys soon as well.
And can we tell everybody you're talking to us from your closet?
Absolutely. Isn't everybody talking from closets these days?
All right. On that note, we have to wrap up. This is David and Nikki Nellis, Foodie and the Beast. When we come back, Top Chef Eric Adjapon, he's going to be doing some classes, and we're going to get educated. We'll be back in just a sec.
All right, we're back on Foodie and the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis, and we are honored and thrilled to have Chef Eric Adjapon with us. Chef Eric was a finalist on season 16 of Bravo's Top Chef and a contestant on season 17 of Top Chef All-Stars. You got to be good to be an all-star. And he recently launched a series of interactive cooking classes online, and he's opening a restaurant. He's a busy guy. So, Eric, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm doing well. It's good to be on with you guys, Dave, Andrew, Nikki. It's good to see you guys and share the space on this platform. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So, Eric, it's been a while since we had you on. I think we had you on right after you were on Bravo's Top Chef.
That's right.
Season 16. And you were doing catering, basically. So what has been going on for you in the last year, year and a half?
It's been an interesting ride the past year and a half. I feel like everyone's kind of in the same boat as far as just not really anticipating everything that we had planned in the beginning of the year isn't necessarily what's going on right now. And I think that boat and that flow, but it's been interesting. I, like you mentioned, had in mind to open up the restaurant this month, actually in spring in May. It's been tough, you know, obviously just having to push back due to like the district's kind of social distancing kind of mandates and things like that. So we're hoping to open up hopefully this fall or winter. And in the meantime, I've just kind of been, sorry, I got the little one in the background.
We are fine with that. Okay.
Wait till the dogs start barking here.
Yeah, our dogs will start barking. It's fine. My daughter will come in and ask me a question. That's just how it works when we're
doing it like this. It's been interesting, kind of pivoting over to the virtual classes, which has been a lot of fun. I've always taught classes, whether it be in New York or DC and Baltimore. So kind of do it on a virtual platform is really cool. I've been able to kind of teach folks not only like everywhere domestically, but internationally as well, which has been insane.
Well, let's just back up a little bit. So for people who didn't know, let's sort of talk about the kind of cooking that you do. What was the kind of cooking you do for catering and what you were doing, planning on doing at your new restaurant, and then how that lends itself to the kind of classes you're now hosting?
Yeah, I think it was really West African and really food of the diaspora is really what I love to champion. I am a first generation Ghanaian American. My folks came here to the States late 80s. So I'm literally the first person in my entire family born here in the States, which is really cool because it's
me too.
That's awesome. Yeah, exactly. It's given me that awesome kind of dichotomy of just growing up, not only like living in a New York City, you know, in the Bronx as a New York City kid, but then also just growing up in a very traditional West African home. So I've been able to kind of like pair the flavors and the profiles and the techniques with the things that I've kind of grew up eating and things that I loved and kind of like second nature to me. And everything else that I kind of learned, you know, afterwards, growing up in and going to school in Johnson & Wales University, and you know, going to work in New York in a couple of different Michelin stars restaurants, and just kind of having that idea to really bridge the gap between the food that I knew and was so familiar with a lot of the techniques that I loved to learn and was learning on the fly, especially in a lot of the modern restaurants that I had. So it was kind of like a seamless transition and one that made a lot of sense to me.
Well, but to come from a rich West African culture where you've got, and then here, we've got all these mixes. Tell us what you're teaching in the classes, because there must be some crazy dishes.
No, crazy good dishes.
Yeah, yeah, crazy good. No, absolutely. I mean, that's a very, like, it's a great point. I mean, the food of that diaspora, the West African diaspora, is just like kind of ubiquitous with a lot of things that we eat and familiar with today. We just unfortunately just don't know about it. I think you talk about, I have a Caribbean class coming up, like a barbecue picnic class coming up, and we'll do things like cebolo or sorrel, which is like a ubiquitous kind of drink throughout the diaspora. Some people call it sorrel, some people call it cibolo, but really it's just like hibiscus sweetened drink, hibiscus leaves that come from Nigeria, dried up, and it's like soaked in a beautiful tea, pineapple, ginger, orange, allspice, cinnamon, some simple syrup. You can spike it with some rum if you wanted to as well. It's like, it's absolutely delicious, but it's
that sounds good.
That's again ubiquitous throughout the diaspora. Things like, I don't know, fried snapper and escovitch is something that you might be able to get on the class. I do a traditional Indian Trinidadian dish called doubles that actually is going to be kind of marketed off the restaurant that I have opening up in the Union Market. What else? I teach jollof rice, but I do it in a risotto. So you're getting like the traditional kind of flavors and kind of understanding and background of those notes that you would get in a traditional like jollof kind of rice in Ghana. Or, but then
what do you do with goat?
Oh gosh, curry goat. I love curry goat. I love braising goat. Goat is absolutely delicious. We'll do a bunch of
that. Let me ask you a question. So with your classes, how do people take them? Because right now in this time of the pandemic, there's, you know, we have this ability to do all these things virtually, which is amazing. I think it's going to really change when we get back to some sort of normalcy. Right. It's really going to change access for people. So if I couldn't normally go to your class in your kitchen, now I can Zoom in and still participate in some way, right?
Yeah,
so
that's a really, really
good point. How are you doing it now?
That's a really, really good point. I think even for the folks, like, let's say, outside of my kind of like close proximity, folks that live in like the Midwest and California and such, they don't have direct access to come to DC all the time and have food from me or any other DC chef or whatever the case is. So these virtual platforms are really awesome because all you have to do is really just sign up on the website. You know, you'll sign up with the time and date that suits you for the class that you like. You'll get the recipe and ingredients and equipment list a few days prior. You'll go out to your local grocer, you'll find it. Most of everything is really accessible at a Whole Foods, Wegmans, kind of Kroger's type of thing. And the night before, I'll send you the link and we literally cook together. I mean, soups to nuts, like we do everything. I just ask you to kind of have everything prepped. I mean, not prepped, but just like ready. And we'll prep everything and there's multiple cameras so you can kind of see all the different views and it's really interactive. You have time to, you know, ask questions and poke fun of people at, you know, that are also participating in the chat room, which is a lot of fun as well. And it's just a great time. I mean, I've had classes where folks are, you know, celebrating anniversaries and birthdays and group parties and things like that. I mean, this really has been an amazing feat. And at the end of the day, people are just so excited and appreciative to try something new and cook something different, but and also spend some valuable time with the people that they love.
Well, we'll put the link, Nikki will put it up on the list so everybody can find it. But talk a little bit about what's coming up
for you. No, it's already up on the list.
It's already there.
Come on.
What do I know? You also got a project at Union Market that got delayed, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, David, it's
on
been-
the double.
Yeah, on the double. I'm excited to open it up. Been
so
planning.
Is it in the market or is it in the Union Market
Correct.
Area?
Yeah, it's in the market, within the market. But obviously just, you know, the market itself, they're looking to just put me in the best position as possible, be as successful as possible. So obviously they're doing the best to keep the city safe. Union Market is one of the bigger hubs in DC as far as foot traffic and things like that. So as far as them, they're in the forefront as far as just trying to keep the district as safe as possible. And they've had to kind of cut occupancy and not allow folks to come in and doing delivery. So in and of itself, it's probably not the best time to open up a restaurant, so to speak, just kind of-
In a food hall?
Yeah. Yeah, in a food hall, right.
Right. Exactly. In a food hall specifically.
Eric, you're not only a great chef, you're a brilliant seer in the business.
Smart business. So before we have to wrap up with you, we'll get, you know, the link for people to sign up for your classes. But can you just tell everybody like what happened on Top Chef for you?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was an interesting ride. We went to LA, it was wild. I competed against 14 other amazing chefs that have been on throughout the crazy 16 seasons that Top Chef franchise has been alive and well. I finished in the middle of the pack, which I'm proud of. I mean, there was some stiff competition. I mean, you're talking about Melissa King, Brian Voltaggio, Jen Carroll, like these guys are powerhouses and folks that I grew up admiring as well. So I'm just one appreciative of Bravo and Top Chef reaching out to me to do this crazy, insane adventure all over again. But I had a blast and it really was something that I'll never forget and have gained a world of knowledge and networking and power as well.
Well, congratulations on all your success. It's always good to catch up with you. Tell everybody where they can find you on the web so that they can sign up for your classes.
Nikki, Andrew, David, guys, thank you again. It's always a pleasure. www.chefajapong.com/classes. You'll be able to see all the list of the classes, the times and dates, and more pertinent information. Guys, I really, really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
It's so good to have you. You're a good guest.
Thank you, guys.
So we want to thank you for joining us again on Foodie and the Beast from home. As always, we had an amazing show with incredible guests. You can always download this and listen to it on the podcast. You can follow me at NYCCINELLIS on Instagram, Facebook, on Twitter. We have everything that is going on in the DC food and wine community, like Eric's classes or where you can find what Julia Coney is doing. All the amazing, delicious things that are happening is there for you. So we want to thank you all for joining us, and everybody, please have a delicious week.
Whether you're making the same breakfast that you have every day or baking a cake for an extra special day, eggs are a staple in our diets. Eggland's Best eggs are nutritionally superior to ordinary eggs, containing more vitamins and 25% less saturated fat. Not only are they better for you, but Eggland's Best eggs taste better too. There's a reason that they're America's number one eggs. Visit egglandsbest.com for additional information and delicious recipes.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.